Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, it's Graham here from True North True Crime. This week we're excited to drop a TNTC Plus bonus episode into your feeds for free. For those who might not know, we offer a subscription tier of the podcast through Apple Podcast Subscription or Patreon. For just $5 a month, you'll receive our regular episodes on Mondays instead of Thursdays. Subscribing ensures that all of our episodes are ad-free, and once a month, we also release an exclusive bonus episode, just like the one you're about to listen to. The Apple Podcast app offers a 7-day free trial for TNTC Plus, so if you want to check it out and enjoy some bonus content, just hit the free trial button. If you're not an Apple user, you can head on over to Patreon and subscribe there. And for all of our existing TNTC Plus subscribers, we want to express our gratitude to you for your continued support. All right, we'll see you soon with a new episode, but until then, sit back, relax, and enjoy this TNTC Plus bonus episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to your November TNTC Plus exclusive episode. Thank you so much for being here. If you have a case suggestion for us to cover on a TNTC Plus episode or a regular feed episode, please send us an email to truenorthtruecrime@gmail.com. We do prioritize cases that come to us directly from family or close contacts of a case, but are more than happy to receive suggestions from everyone. Without further ado, let's go ahead and get right into tonight's episode.
So today we are talking about a triple homicide that occurred back in 2008. Many Canadians will likely be familiar with this case as it made national headlines. However, the ripple effect that this case has caused is still having impacts today, which is why we chose to cover it. As Canadians, we have built a robust system of social safety nets. However, this case demonstrates what happens when that safety net falls apart. This case sheds a light on the shortcomings and lack of cohesion among organizations and government ministries that are intended to serve as a line of defense in protecting children and families from various forms of harm. While we acknowledge the dedication of many intelligent and compassionate individuals working in social services to provide that safety, it's clear that the bureaucratic inefficiencies and disorganization within these ministries can give rise to significant challenges. So in this episode, we will be detailing the case of Alan Schoenborn and the events that would eventually lead him to kill his three children, Caitlin, Max, and Corden. We put this episode together using publicly available news articles, archived news articles, court documents, and a very robust investigative report that the RCY, or Representative for Children and Youth, put out in 2012. Content warnings for this episode include domestic violence, violence against women, intimate partner violence, crimes against children, drug and alcohol addiction, mental illness, and the unnatural death of three young children. We know that child murder episodes are tough for people. If you are unable to listen to this one, we understand, and we will see you on a future episode. If you do listen to it, please take care of yourselves.
Alan Schoenborn and his common law partner, Darcy Clark, had been together for 14 years when this triple homicide occurred. Alan worked as a roofer and was the family's sole breadwinner. Darcy was a stay-at-home mother, and the two insist that there were little to no issues in their relationship until their first child was born in 1998. Alan and Darcy had three children. Caitlin was born in 1998, Max came in 1999, and finally Corden, who arrived in 2002, and the family was living in the Greater Vancouver area up until 2007. According to people who knew the Schoenborn family, Caitlin was a well-liked, bubbly, sociable, and intelligent little girl. She loved to sing and was always willing to lend a helping hand. School staff recall her as exceptionally bright and a high-achieving student. Quote, she was really well-adjusted and didn't feel the need to belong to any particular group. If she liked what was going on, she was a part of it. If she didn't, she was fine on her own, said one member of the school staff who continued, everybody liked her because she was very kind. She often had insights into things in the classroom that her teacher would talk about that were wise beyond her years. And this mature wisdom was also acknowledged by staff members at Caitlin's previous school, where she was celebrated for her exceptional artistic talents. Caitlin was Alan and Darcy's oldest child and had a special bond with her mother. Darcy describes her daughter as her best friend and recalls that they had a very specific bedtime routine, which consisted of tucking Caitlin in and putting on the same movie that she would fall asleep to every night. Max was the couple's second child, and he was also an incredibly kind and friendly kid. He loved soccer and being outside and made friends easily. According to school records, Max is described as helpful, respectful, and tried his very best at school. The couple's youngest child, Corden, was similar to his two siblings in the fact that he was also very well liked and had many friends at his new school. He's remembered as being a little ball of joy and for his enthusiastic attitude towards life. Corden's school record states, he enjoyed listening to stories, interacted positively with others, and participated with enthusiasm in music and dance activities. Now, as the kids got older, they began to notice that their father was unwell. Caitlin, in particular, began to take note of Alan's mental health struggles as well as his addiction issues. This escalated to a point where Caitlin started acting protective of her mother and even wished that her father would stay locked up in prison instead of being at home with the family. So let's go ahead and get into the various run-ins with law enforcement amongst other organizations such as MCFD, which is the Ministry of Children and Family Development, and RCY, the Representative for Children and Youth, that the family began to have in the late 90s and early 2000s. It's important to note here that we are only going to be able to highlight certain incidents as there are far too many to get into fully, and for the sake of time, we will be leaving some out. So if you'd like the full timeline of events leading up to April 6th, 2008, you can read the report that the RCY put out in 2012, and we will link that for our listeners in the show notes of this episode.
Now, the first time that MCFD had contact with the Schoenborn family was in June of 1999. Alan was driving his car with his daughter Caitlin in the back seat. He was bringing her to the hospital because he was adamant that his daughter had been poisoned and that her mother was sexually abusing her. While he was driving to the hospital with Caitlin in the vehicle, Alan got into two car accidents, and the second one rendered his vehicle unusable. They ended up being brought to the hospital by ambulance, and when they arrived, Alan then refused to let the hospital staff examine his daughter. When they were finally able to take a look at Caitlin, they could find nothing wrong with her. MCFD social workers initiated an investigation during which they conducted an interview with Darcy, the mom, who was 6 months pregnant with Max at this time. She reported that her common law husband, Alan, had been exhibiting escalating signs of suspicion and paranoia over the last preceding months. Their relationship had been strained due to his intense jealousy, frequent unfounded accusations of her engaging in extramarital affairs, and allegations of her drugging and harming their daughter. She also disclosed that Alan had been consuming cannabis along with large quantities of alcohol. Alan's behavior was so concerning to Darcy that she had brought him to a family doctor who prescribed tranquilizers. Alan did take the medication for a few days before quitting abruptly after he found that they made him feel groggy. The doctor also referred him to mental health services, but he never went. Darcy also told MCFD workers that she was afraid of Alan and that she didn't feel that she could prevent him from taking their daughter in his truck to the hospital that day. In her words, her husband was, quote, becoming a totally different man from the one that she had known him to be. The conclusion of this investigation was that Darcy was going to remove herself as well as her daughter from the residence that she and Alan shared, and she would go stay with a relative. She also agreed to call law enforcement should Alan show up where she was staying. The investigation was closed 48 hours after it began, and they found that no child protection concerns were involved, like meaning the kids did not need to be taken away. Here's a direct quote from the MCFD worker. I would have child protection concerns if your daughter's father were to have unsupervised access to his daughter without first receiving a mental health assessment and without following through with the psychiatrist's recommendations of medications and/or treatment. You have clearly shown that you are willing and able to protect your daughter and that you will not allow the father to take your daughter unsupervised until his mental health has significantly improved. When Alan visited the hospital that night with his daughter, the staff were so concerned about his actions in the ER that they involuntarily committed him. He was exhibiting concerning behaviors such as extreme anxiety, anger, confusion, and paranoia. However, it was the signs of paranoid psychosis that led doctors to the decision to have him transferred and involuntarily committed. But once Alan was transferred to the other hospital, he fled the premises. He was eventually caught up with, arrested, and readmitted. According to Alan, on the day he drove his daughter to the hospital, he said he was at work when he heard concerning reports over the radio of 20 women in the city going missing. After Alan heard this, he rushed home to make sure his wife and daughter were safe, and once he got home, he left in his truck with his daughter. He also expressed suspicion of his wife's infidelity due to her lack of affection and admitted to questioning her and even attempting to verify fidelity by smelling her. He also mentioned a long-standing difficulty trusting people, believing his colleagues were deceitful. He resisted hospitalization, fearing prolonged institutionalization. So he wouldn't even talk to doctors about these things that he was thinking because he knew or felt that he would be locked up. He disclosed a prior episode of acute psychosis a decade previous in a different province. Now, during that period, he underwent a 7-day hospitalization and was prescribed an antipsychotic medication, but he did not follow through with any aftercare plan and discontinued taking the medication. Also in June of 1999, during the same time frame as the hospital visit with Caitlin, where he was involuntarily committed, a second physician certification was required in order to commit him for a longer period of time. Now, the second examination was conducted by a general practitioner 3 days later. This doctor concluded that Schonborn did not meet the criteria for certification. The general practitioner found Schonborn to be completely calm, with normal speech, good insight, and no signs of delusion or paranoid beliefs. Alan acknowledged his earlier irrationality and no longer held his previous paranoid delusions about his wife's infidelity or his daughter's condition. Darcy also confirmed his account and didn't view him as a threat to anyone. However, Darcy later revealed to the RCY investigators that she had hoped that Alan would remain in the hospital for stabilization with medication. She agreed with the attending psychiatrist that a mere couple of days wouldn't be sufficient for his recovery, leaving her feeling helpless.
Now, we warn you, as we go forward, there are going to be more instances of Darcy experiencing indecision on her desire to have Alan removed from her and her children's lives. We know that victims of domestic violence and abuse often have a hard time getting themselves the help that they need, and we don't know the full picture of what may have been happening behind closed doors in terms of threats being made or other types of manipulation Alan could have been using on Darcy. So we know that Darcy made mistakes, but we also want to highlight that she and the children were victims of Alan Schoenborn. So, on June 21st, 1999, Schoenborn signed a waiver of responsibility acknowledging his decision to leave the hospital against medical advice. The consequences of his choice were placed solely on him rather than the hospital, and he was a free man. Alan's discharge diagnosis upon leaving the hospital was a delusional disorder. During his hospitalization, he was prescribed an antipsychotic medication, and this medication was continued with a prescription upon his release. He also received medication to manage the side effects from that antipsychotic medication. There is no evidence in records or interviews to suggest that Alan had further contact with the mental health system. He informed RCY investigators that he wanted to address his mental health issues on his own. MCFD had no further interaction with the Schoenborn family for the next 3 years. In September 2002, the family relocated to another city in the Lower Mainland. And for listeners who don't live in BC, the Lower Mainland encompasses Vancouver as well as the Fraser Valley. On September 26, 2002, MCFD once again got involved with the family. This time it was because Darcy had refused a public health nurse visiting the family home after her son Max was born. The nurse wanted to do a postnatal examination because Max had been born with a concerningly low birth weight, and there were reports of secondhand smoke at the residence. Now, a nurse did end up successfully visiting the home between September 26, 2002 and October 15, 2002, and all was seemingly well. MCFD followed up with Darcy offering to assist her in finding a doula, but Darcy declined. On October 16, 2002, MCFD received a phone call from Darcy, who expressed that she was no longer interested in receiving support, and she believed the ministry was attempting to spy on her family. This resulted in MCFD offering Darcy and Alan to come in for an in-person meeting to iron out any concerns they were having. But Darcy stated she wasn't interested and felt that she was now being harassed by MCFD.
On November 6, 2002, an MCFD social worker again concluded their investigation, determining that there were no child protection concerns. Subsequent checks with the family's physician and the public health nurse did not reveal any other issues. In the closing summary, the MCFD social worker noted that the family was unwilling to participate in any services and expressed a lack of cooperation. Given the absence of sufficient grounds, a decision was made not to pursue more intrusive measures at that time. However, it was recommended that if future intakes revealed viable protection concerns, the MCFD would consider more invasive interventions, such as removing the children. Following this investigation, the MCFD had no further contact with the family until 2007, approximately 4.5 years later. Unfortunately, it wasn't all peaceful for the family in the years between 2002 and 2007. Alan continued to deteriorate with his mental health issues and his substance misuse. Darcy recalls that his behavior would escalate when he was working because he had more money to spend on more drugs and alcohol. He would come home from work and drink all through the night, often keeping Darcy up with him even though she had to take care of the children the following day. The police were also called to the residence on numerous occasions during this time for various instances, like things like uttering threats, suspected drugs in the vehicle, a dispute with a neighbor, and a drunken altercation between Alan and his brother. It was May 17, 2007 when MCFD was brought back into the picture. This was in response to a call that came in from Darcy to the police with regards to Alan coming home very intoxicated and initiating a violent argument, which culminated in Alan throwing an alarm clock through a window. Now, this was a closed window. It resulted in shattered glass everywhere. Darcy reported that Alan had become increasingly aggressive and destructive in their home. He yelled at her, damaged property, and even threatened her life. Fearing for her safety and the safety of her children, she fled the house and called the police. She expressed her ongoing fear of her husband and her desire to end their relationship while requesting a restraining order. This incident prompted the police to inform the MCFD about the situation. Now, during the police investigation of the May 17, 2007 incident, Darcy revealed a disturbing event that had occurred 2 days prior. She recounted that on May 15, 2007, Alan arrived home intoxicated and consumed with jealousy. He coerced her into performing sexual acts against her will, accompanied by threats of severe physical violence if she refused. This traumatic ordeal endured for several hours.
It's worth noting that Darcy later composed a letter to Crown Counsel a few weeks later recanting the sexual assault accusations and urging that Allen not be charged for these allegations. She informed RCY investigators that the allegations were in fact true, but that she had been pressured by Allen into recanting them. The reports of the sexual assault and other violence going on in the Schoenborn home resulted in Allen being arrested on May 18, 2007. He was charged with uttering threats and sexual assault. After his arrest, Darcy took the kids and left their home to go and stay with a relative. The police informed Allen that he would not be allowed to contact Darcy or his children upon his release, and to that, Allen responded that he would return to their residence and show her. There was no documentation indicating that Darcy was directed to a community-based victim support program designed to aid in addressing the practical safety requirements of both herself and her children after this incident. Just hours after Allen was arrested, he was released on bail. He did have conditions, though, which were as follows: keep the peace and be of good behavior, not to possess any weapons as defined in the Criminal Code of Canada, including knives, except when immediately preparing or consuming food, not to have in your possession any alcohol and refrain absolutely from consuming alcohol, have no direct or indirect contact with the mother, Darcy, Caitlin, Max, or Corden, not to be within a 2-block radius of the family home, not to possess any firearms, explosive substances, or ammunition as defined in the Criminal Code of Canada. However, there was no requirement for Allen to report to a bail officer after his release, and therefore the conditions of his bail weren't monitored. There is also no record that the conditions of Allen's release were ever communicated to Darcy, or what her next step should be if she should become aware that Allen was in breach of any of these conditions. The only attempt to speak with Darcy and ensure she had support after this incident happened on May 18th, when a police officer contacted the domestic violence department to reach out to Darcy. They made plans to have a meeting on May 23rd, but Darcy was a no-show to this meeting, and then there was no further follow-ups done. On May 22, 2007, the Ministry of Children and Family Development initiated its third investigation, commencing 4 days after Allen was arrested and released. This report arrived following the May-long weekend, and the subsequent actions unfolded as follows. On the evening of May 22, 2007, an after-hours social worker and a police officer paid an unannounced visit to the Schoenborn residence. The social worker refrained from entering the home after being informed by the children's mother that the children were asleep. Instead, she provided Darcy with a business card containing the MCFD district office's contact information and reminded her to reach out to the police if Allen showed up at their home.
The following day, on May 23, 2007, an MCFD worker conducted a home visit. During this visit, Darcy explained that she had ended her relationship with Allen after the events of May 17th. She conveyed that his increased use of cannabis and alcohol had contributed to a decline in his mental health, resulting in uncontrollable, violent, and aggressive behavior. Darcy indicated that Allen had not undergone any recent psychiatric assessment, though she was encouraging him to do so. She also shared her fear of Allen based on prior incidents. Importantly, she expressed a desire not to press charges against him. Instead, she wished for him to receive help and believed that pursuing criminal charges would hinder his chances of getting the assistance that he needed. She also stated that the children did not fear their father and that they actually maintained a positive relationship with him. The social worker collaborated with Darcy to establish the following safety plan. Darcy committed to safeguarding her children by preventing Allen from entering the home and refraining from allowing him to communicate with the children over the phone. In the event that Allen appeared at the residence, she would promptly contact the police. If Allen expressed a desire to see the children, she was instructed to reach out to the MCFD social worker, who would arrange a supervised visit at the MCFD office. For sustained contact with the children, Allen was obligated to engage in various support services, including parenting classes, programs for managing aggression and violence, and treatment from alcohol addiction. Darcy consented to collaborate with a family support worker for continuous monitoring and assistance, and then she also committed to ensure adherence to the safety plan. Now, to ensure adherence to the safety plan, the after-hours MCFD team would conduct unannounced home visits at irregular intervals. But it seems that the MCFD worker wasn't aware of Alan's existing bail conditions, because if they were, they would have realized that one of his conditions was not to have any contact, indirect or direct, with Darcy, Caitlin, Max, or Corden, which would make their safety plan a breach of his bail conditions. On May 23, 2007, Alan made an unannounced visit to the MCFD office, seeking to have a conversation with a social worker. Now, unfortunately, the intake social worker was unavailable at that moment, and Alan declined to wait. Office workers reported that he became incredibly aggressive and rude with them before leaving. Subsequently, the intake social worker that he was looking for reached out to Alan to schedule a meeting on May 28, 2007.
So, the following day, on May 24th, 2007, Darcy made an unplanned visit to the police station with a request to lift Alan's no-contact release conditions. The assigned officer for the case was unavailable at that time, so another officer conducted a roughly 40-minute videotaped interview with Darcy. During this interview, Darcy explained that because Alan was already visiting her and the children daily, she wanted the restrictions on contact to be removed. Despite her disclosure that Alan was violating his bail conditions regularly, the police did not follow up on this matter. Despite significant efforts by the officer to persuade her otherwise, Darcy insisted that she did not want Alan to face charges. Instead, she expressed a strong desire to help him. She believed that sending him to jail would not be beneficial and found the contact restrictions too limiting, deeming them unfair. Within the same interview, Darcy disclosed another domestic violence incident from 2001. She recounted that this incident occurred after Alan had been heavily drinking and using increasing amounts of marijuana. She reported that during an unprovoked argument, Alan struck her in the face, resulting in a broken nose. When she went to seek medical treatment at the hospital, she falsely attributed her injury to tripping over the family dog. Years later, when questioned by the police about this incident, Alan claimed it was accidental, stating that he had intended to strike the wall, not his wife. The police officer attempted to make the mother aware of the gravity of the assault and its potential impact on her children, but she expressed a belief that there was no negative effect on them. She believed that MCFD's actions in keeping the children away from their father were detrimental and that she would not reconcile with Alan until he sought help for his alcohol dependency and mental health issues. Not only did Darcy not fear for her safety, she did not think he would harm her again, characterizing the May 17th incident as an isolated incident fueled by intoxication. She also felt that the MCFD social workers had unfairly judged Alan without meeting him. Throughout their conversation, the police officer continued to emphasize the cycle of violence that Darcy was in and asked how she would react if her daughter were in a similar situation. Darcy stated that she would take drastic measures to protect her daughter, but persisted in her stance that charges should not be pressed. She also held the belief that she had control over whether charges would be filed. She didn't realize that this decision actually rested with Crown Counsel. The police officer reluctantly ended the interview and told Darcy that he would have someone from the domestic violence department contact her to answer any questions or concerns. She was also provided with various information pamphlets to take along with her. However, it doesn't appear as though anyone ever actually followed up with Darcy after this interview, and as we already stated, even though Darcy had just told the police that Alan had been breaching his bail conditions, no one ever followed up on that either. Now, on May 28, 2007, keep in mind this is 10 days after Alan was arrested for sexual assault and uttering threats, Alan showed up at his daughter's school. He was again aggressive and demanding to know where his daughter was. He was asked to leave, and Alan told the administrative staff that he had every right to be there and just wanted to know that his children were in school. Eventually, Alan left the premises but returned hours later. When he returned, he was demanding to see his kids. The school did call MCFD, and they reported that Alan cooperated with their request for him to leave. MCFD informed the school staff that there was a no-contact order in place and that they should inform the police of this incident. However, no call was ever made to the police, which was also in breach of the school's policy.
So fast forward to August 22, 2007. An MCFD social worker observed that Alan was visiting the family home daily to see the children and their mother. But Alan was not engaged in any support services for his mental health, nor had he met with MCFD social workers to address the protection concerns. Potentially most concerning of all was that Darcy told the social worker that she was planning on getting back together with Alan. Now, the rules that the MCFD had set out as a part of a safety plan included that Darcy was to prevent Alan from entering the home, and if he showed up, Darcy was supposed to call the police. If Alan wanted to see the kids, there were steps that he needed to take, which included anger management, substance misuse treatment, and monitored visits. But this was just a safety plan and not legally binding. There were also seemingly no legal consequences for his breach of a bail order that had occurred. So the MCFD social worker consulted with her team leader about this situation and was advised that an immediate response was not necessary. Instead, she was directed to meet with the children's mother, Darcy, and ascertain her new plan for ensuring her safety. Now, at the end of August in 2007, a series of events occurred that would ultimately lead the family moving 300 kilometers away to Merritt, British Columbia. These cascading incidents began on August 23rd, 2007, when Alan showed up at the house where Darcy and the children were living, and he brought alcohol. As he progressively became more intoxicated, an argument broke out, and according to Darcy, it was more of the jealous behavior from Alan that he had exhibited on previous occasions. At some point during this heated fight, Alan ran out of the house and into the street where he confronted a driver who was allegedly speeding. Darcy proceeded to lock Alan out of the home and then called the police. Alan would end up breaking back into the house and would be charged with breaching his peace bond. This resulted in MCFD opening yet another investigation, and this time they suggested that Darcy pack up her things and take her children to stay in another community to keep themselves safe. So the MCFD then labeled this case as high risk, and all of the same conditions were put on Darcy, despite these conditions not being followed in the past. Things like Alan wasn't allowed to have access to the kids, and if he showed up, Darcy would call law enforcement immediately.
1 week later, on August 31st, 2007, MCFD received information that Darcy and her children had gone back to their residence in the Lower Mainland. This decision was made despite advice from the family preservation worker and the MCFD social worker, who had strongly recommended against returning home due to child protection concerns related to contact with Alan. As an alternative to returning home, the family preservation worker proposed assisting in packing and relocating their belongings. She also suggested that the children's mother considered starting anew in a new community in the interior rather than going back to the Lower Mainland and exposing herself and her children to the potential risks associated with Alan. Darcy agreed and began the process of moving herself and her children to British Columbia's interior city of Merritt.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On the same day, August 31st, 2007, two MCFD social workers, accompanied by the police, visited the family's Lower Mainland residence and found Alan Schoenborn assisting them in packing for their relocation to Merritt. Darcy conveyed to the social workers that she did not perceive the father as a threat to their children. Alan expressed confusion about why he couldn't be with his family when he was not under the influence of alcohol. He mentioned that the court order conditions were different from those imposed by MCFD. Faced with the situation, the MCFD social worker presented the mother with two options: either go to a transition home with the children or have the children placed in MCFD custody. Eventually, Darcy chose to leave with the children and stay at a relative's home approximately an hour away. It would later be revealed that Alan, in fact, joined the family and they left together for Merritt. The MCFD social workers approved the move as a safe response to child protection concerns, unaware that Alan had initiated this plan and that he would be going along with the family. In September 2007, Darcy and the kids were residing in a motel in Merritt, and they would later relocate to a mobile home in the area. There was evidence that Alan Schoenborn was living alongside the family on occasion during this time. On September 4, 2007, the Lower Mainland MCFD office referred their case to the Interior MCFD office for courtesy services. This arrangement meant that the Lower Mainland office would retain the main responsibility for the case, and the Interior office would respond to any directives from the Lower Mainland office. The MCFD social worker sent an email to an intake social worker at the Interior office, providing a brief overview of the case. She highlighted that the most recent incident at the end of August had been life-threatening and dangerous. Additionally, she expressed concern that the children's mother, Darcy, continued to downplay the violence as well as its impact on the children.
Then, on October 22, 2007, an MCFD social worker from Vancouver again contacted the Interior or Merritt-based social worker due to concerns about Darcy's persistent denial of the danger that she was in. The social worker sought guidance on what support could be provided to the mother and her children. Unfortunately, there is no evidence of a response to this request from the Merritt social worker. Now, this is when a massive failure occurred on the part of MCFD. An MCFD social worker in the Lower Mainland noted in the electronic file that the children's mother had relocated to the Interior and was receiving support from her extended family as a part of a safety plan. The notation stated, "File to be transferred for ongoing family support." The investigation was officially closed on November 16, 2007, with the determination that there were no child protection concerns. Instead, support services were offered. Subsequently, the social worker from the Lower Mainland office responsible for this case left the MCFD. There is no documentation identifying that a new social worker had taken over this case. At this point, a file transfer did not occur, so this file was not handed from one office to another. Instead, MCFD staff from both offices opted for an arrangement called courtesy services. Now, as stated, under this arrangement, the Lower Mainland office retained responsibility for managing the file, while the Interior office was provided directives from the Lower Mainland office. But unfortunately, staff from both offices did not clearly define or document the specifics of what courtesy services entailed. This obviously led to confusion amongst MCFD workers, as it wasn't communicated as to what further actions were needed and who was in charge of what on this file. Now for Alan, he wasn't done breaking the law yet. And on November 22, 2007, on a trip back to the Lower Mainland, Alan was charged with impaired driving after crashing into two parked cars at a gas station. He received a 24-hour driving suspension and later a 3-month driving prohibition.
The following day, November 23, 2007, Alan was arrested due to an outstanding bench warrant and placed under supervised bail conditions for both the November 2007 impaired driving incident and the August 2007 breach of bail charges. On November 26, 2007, Alan was released with an additional condition requiring him to report to a bail supervisor. On December 19, 2007, Alan was stopped by the police while driving despite being prohibited. He was arrested but released without specific conditions, with instructions to appear in court on February 21, 2008. So let's fast forward to April of 2008, and a lot happens in a very short period of time, a week, in fact. From April 1st to 4th, Alan got himself into even more legal trouble. On April 1st, 2008, there were several incidents involving Allen, which included more visits to his children's school and interactions with authorities. The MCFD received a call from the school reporting his presence, where he expressed concerns about his children's well-being and his fear that Darcy might leave with them. Additionally, a community member informed MCFD that Allen had been seen living at the children's mother's home, which, as we all know, was in breach of the contact restrictions that are in place. MCFD social workers, accompanied by the police, went to Darcy's home but found no one there. They later received information that Allen was at the MCFD office, and they decided to keep him there until police could arrest him for an outstanding warrant. Following a tense discussion, Allen Schoenborn was arrested on the outstanding warrant for driving while prohibited. This marked the second time he had visited the MCFD office in an attempt to engage with social workers, and both times, the police were involved. Allen expressed frustration with the police presence, feeling it distracted from addressing his family issues. On April 2nd, 2008, Allen appeared in court for the driving while prohibited charge. He was released on supervised bail and met with a bail supervisor. The bail supervisor did not observe any signs of mental health issues, but noted that Allen Schoenborn mentioned reconciling with his common-law wife and planning a move.
That evening, Allen boarded a bus at a bus station after consuming a bottle of wine. In the early hours of April 3, 2008, he arrived in Merritt and was arrested for public intoxication. He was held in the police cells and released later that same day. Upon his release, he went to his children's school and visited multiple times, expressing concern about their safety. His behavior alarmed school staff, leading to calls to the police. Allen was subsequently arrested once more on April 3rd, 2008. Keep in mind, he had just been released from the cells, and now he was arrested for uttering threats at the school. He briefly attempted to escape the police custody, but of course was restrained. Authorities did not perceive that his behavior was unusually aggressive or agitated, even though he had been arrested, released, and rearrested on the same day. Now, what happens next is an example of multiple organizations failing to communicate effectively, resulting in a tragedy that absolutely could have been avoided. On April 3rd, this is the same day of 2008, the MCFD reached out to the police in Merritt, requesting a meeting with Allen in the police cells. Now, the purpose of this meeting was to discuss the gravity of the situation and convey that the children might be removed if Allen had contact with them. Like, they wanted to really clarify this for Allen. Now, there are conflicting accounts of how the police responded to this. And keep in mind, MCFD hasn't been super effective in their communication either. So, according to the MCFD, they received two differing recollections. One suggested that the police refused access, not wanting to appear to be involved in a child removal case. And then the other communication that they think that they received was that the police had declined the MCFD presence due to concerns about Allen's agitation, which they didn't want to escalate. So that's MCFD's POV. However, when questioned, the police don't recall the phone call or MCFD's request to be present. They also stated that Allen did not appear super agitated in the cells. The MCFD social worker mentioned that the police said that they would inform MCFD before they released Allen, but the police did not recall this conversation. So Allen was once again released for the second time on April 3rd, 2008.
On the weekend of April 5th and 6th, 2008, Allen was the primary caregiver for the children staying at their home while Darcy stayed at a relative's apartment in the same community. This arrangement was actually imposed by the MCFD due to concerns about the parents' constant arguing. Darcy was feeling overwhelmed and she had sought medical help and counseling a few days earlier. However, she left the therapist's office feeling discouraged as she was told that she should have left Allen by now. She was prescribed anti-anxiety medication and allowed Allen to stay in the family home over the weekend while he waited for income assistance. On the morning of April 5th, 2008, Allen took Caitlin for hot chocolate while Darcy spent time at a park with the boys. Later, Darcy returned to spend the evening with Alan and the children before she left to stay overnight with a relative. During the overnight hours of April 5th into April 6th, Alan began displaying odd behavior. He called Darcy after he had received a call from one of his daughter's friends. Alan refused to allow his daughter to talk to her friend and subsequently called Darcy, demanding to know who the girl that called was. Alan continued calling Darcy up until around midnight, and these calls consisted of him begging her to come back home and reconsider their relationship. Darcy refused and went to bed. Alan put the kids to bed, and sometime after they were asleep, he murdered them. The two boys, Max and Corden, were 5 and 8 years old at the time and were placed on the couch together in a blanket while he left 10-year-old Caitlin in her bed. The next morning, Darcy couldn't reach Alan by phone, and so in the afternoon of April 6, 2008, she walked over to the residence to check on her kids. When she entered the residence, she didn't immediately notice anything wrong and observed her two sons wrapped up in a blanket together on the couch. It was when she got closer that she became alarmed. She noticed her sons' eyes were partially open, their bodies unnaturally rigid, and their skin was purple and cold to the touch. It became evident to her that they had been suffocated. In a frantic search for her daughter Caitlin, she discovered her in bed, covered with a blanket, and noticed a cut on her face. Her pillows had been written on with blood with the words, "Forever Young" and "Gone to Neverland." Additionally, Darcy observed the words, "Forever Young," written on the kitchen wall using soy sauce. But Alan Schoenborn was nowhere to be found.
The following information is from a London Free Press article from April 14, 2008. Quote, Alan Schoenborn has been on the run since April 6 when his three children, Caitlin, 10, Max, 8, and Corden, 5, were found dead in a mobile home in Merritt, located 270 kilometers east of Vancouver. The RCMP, who released a photo of Schoenborn, described him as approximately 5 foot 4 inches tall and weighing 130 pounds, with hazel eyes that can appear yellow, balding, and bearing distinctive scars on his face and both of his ears. He is known to smoke. Many believe that he could have sought refuge in the vast forest near Merritt. The region offers numerous shacks, cabins, and lakes where a person could hide. Despite near-freezing overnight temperatures, survival in the wilderness is possible at this time of year. Sergeant John Price of the Saanich Police, familiar with the area, emphasized the difficulty of finding fugitives in such a vast and remote location. In urban areas, chance encounters and potential witnesses can aid in locating individuals, but in the backcountry, it often relies on inadvertent incidents reported by the public. The RCMP, with over 20 officers on the case and more than 100 tips to investigate, continues its efforts to locate Schoenborn. However, the RCMP wouldn't be the ones to locate Alan Schoenborn. 51-year-old Kim Robinson, a local trapper and hunter who is familiar with the area, took it upon himself to conduct a search in the wilderness. Now, some of you may have heard that name before. He is actually the person who has been looking for the missing cowboy, Ben Tyner, in the Merritt area. Now, during one of these searches, a person who was out walking their dog came across Alan in the woods and subsequently waved Kim Robinson over. Kim stayed with Alan and awaited the arrival of law enforcement. After spending 10 days hiding in the dense forest of British Columbia's interior, Alan Schoenborn was discovered in a severely weakened state. He was found curled up on a hill in the woods near Merritt, dehydrated and near death, according to some accounts. Locals were not surprised by this or by his state, given the challenges of the conditions around the area. The dense forest surrounding Merritt made conducting a wide-scale search challenging for the police. Instead, they focused on following up tips in specific areas. There were questions about why a sweeping search wasn't launched immediately after the discovery of the children's bodies, but the rugged terrain and dense wilderness made it virtually impossible to determine which direction Alan Schoenborn had gone. Once Alan was in police custody, he was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, and Alan would plead not criminally responsible due to his mental illness.
Following Alan's arrest, Darcy participated in a call with him regarding the killings, which was recorded by police as evidence. Darcy told Alan that she didn't want to talk to him unless he explained what he did to the children. She later met with him at a correctional center for a conversation that was also recorded and played at the trial. His trial would begin on October 5th, 2009, and the following is from a Vancouver Sun article from the end of the trial on February 23rd, 2010. Alan Schoenborn, who killed his three children, has been convicted of first-degree murder but found not criminally responsible due to a mental disorder, according to a ruling by BC Supreme Court Justice Robert Powers. The judge based the decision on evidence of Alan's long history of mental illness and psychotic behavior leading up to the killings on April 6, 2008 in Merritt. The Crown's claim that Alan killed his children out of anger or revenge was rejected by the judge, who noted the close and caring relationship that he had with his children. Alan testified that he killed the children because he believed that they were in danger from sexual predators, even though there was no evidence of any sexual abuse. During the verdict reading, Alan had two outbursts, loudly yelling bullshit in disagreement with some of the judge's comments. However, for the rest of the proceeding, he remained quiet and composed. Justice Powers emphasized that Alan's irrational fears about his children's safety did not justify his actions. Alan's future will now be determined by BC's review board, which will assess if he is still mentally ill and poses a risk to the public. Depending on the outcome, he could be released or detained at the Forensic Psychiatric Center in Port Coquitlam, otherwise known as Colony Farm. While the criminal code mandates a life sentence with no parole for 25 years for first-degree murder, Alan's case presents unique challenges due to his mental health condition. Outside the courthouse, Schoenborn's defense lawyer, Peter Wilson, expressed that the judgment was the right result, acknowledging the difficult nature of the case with the facts being described as horrifying and deeply tragic. Finally, on April 6, 2010, the review board made the decision that Alan Schoenborn would be kept at the Forensic Psychiatric Center, or Colony Farm, in Port Coquitlam.
In the years after Alan Schoenborn was convicted of the first-degree murders, but also found not criminally responsible, he continuously applied for parole, or to be transferred to Manitoba, and even requested to be released entirely. Alan would receive an annual review board meeting to discuss whether or not he would be granted more freedoms, and this process, as we know, brings the family and the loved ones of the victims of the crime back into their trauma and grief over and over and over again. But in 2011, Alan was granted supervised day trips back into the community. After a public outcry and learning that Darcy Clark was living in a community not far from where Alan was being held, they reversed their decision. In 2015, the family found themselves back at yet another annual hearing where Alan was once again requesting supervised day trips away from the psychiatric facility. Also around this time in 2015-2016, moves were being made to try to get Alan labeled as a high risk or a dangerous offender, which would mean that the family no longer needed to be subjected to yearly review board meetings. Instead, it would only be once every 3 years, which would allow the victimized family a little bit more time to heal. Unfortunately, in 2017, a BC Supreme Court judge reached the decision that Alan Schoenborn did not meet the criteria for high risk, even though he had been part of multiple violent altercations during his time in custody. In March of 2022, Alan Schoenborn was granted unescorted leaves from the Colony Farm for up to 28 days at a time. And this was, quote, for the purposes of assisting his reintegration into society. Dave Texeria, who is the spokesperson for the victim's family, said the following in a Global News article, quote, it is disappointing but not unexpected. What we have seen consistently over the years is the hospital is eager to have Mr. Schoenborn out, not necessarily better. It just seems like this is another case of victims being re-victimized where public safety is not the paramount concern.
Alan Schoenborn has now been sober for 15 years. However, he continues to show concerning behaviors. Alan still displays recurrent irritability and confrontational behavior towards both staff and fellow patients at Colony Farm. This behavior often arises in reaction to taunts from others and his belief that he is being targeted by staff and patients due to his infamous reputation. The most recent news in regards to Alan came out in February of this year, 2023, where Allen's lawyer postponed the annual review hearing for this year due to reasons that are unclear. But in instances where this has happened before, it was due to Allen being violent or aggressive while in psychiatric care. So for now, Allen Schoenborn remains in custody until at least 2024. In the aftermath of the investigation by RCY, or Representative for Children and Youth, it was found that the deaths of Caitlin, Max, and Corden were indeed preventable. Here's a direct snippet from the analysis and recommendation portion of the investigative report. The deaths of these children were preventable. These children were extremely vulnerable to violence and harm due to the domestic violence in their home and their father's untreated mental illness. Countless opportunities to ensure that the children and their mother were safe were missed because of a profound lack of coordination among the child-serving, mental health, and criminal justice systems over many years, compounded by glaring failures in child protection practice and an inability to recognize and assess the extent of the father's mental illness. Over the week leading up to the children's death, 14 professionals were involved with the family, but appropriate actions were not taken. Complex cases like this involving untreated parental mental illness, domestic violence, and substance abuse demand a high level of collaboration among different service providers from multiple systems, which did not occur in this instance. The children were innocent witnesses to acts of violence directed at their mother and irrational behavior by their father, which must have left them deeply concerned and scared. When a parent's mental illness is recognized and treated, it can be effectively managed with personal supports and services, benefiting the family. However, in this case, the father's mental illness went untreated, and it was not adequately considered as a risk factor in safety planning for the children. Additionally, the family was trapped in a cycle of domestic violence, making it extremely challenging for the mother to protect her children without comprehensive support from various service systems. The child protection system placed immense pressure on her to safeguard her children from their father, but it provided little support or assistance in understanding her situation. There was a lack of understanding of domestic violence dynamics and the father's untreated mental illness, which was never assessed. The interventions and services offered were not effective, and the responses of various systems did not match the severity of the situation. Ultimately, the deaths of these children should have resulted in a reckoning at MCFD. And while we are sure that changes were implemented in the months and years after this tragedy, the MCFD is still making headlines in 2023 for all the wrong reasons. Just this year, a horrific case of child abuse in the Lake Arrock area, which is near Chilliwack, was brought to light. Two foster parents were sentenced to 10 years in prison for manslaughter related to the death of a child in their care. While we won't go into details of this crime, we will let you know that according to the evidence that was presented in court, MCFD failed to check on the children in this case for 7 months.
Mitzi Dean, who is currently the Minister of Children and Family Development, was grilled in reaction to this case, and in response to how these foster children fell through the cracks, Mitzi Dean expressed her condolences to the affected family, friends, and the community, acknowledging that this was indeed a tragedy. She mentioned her horror as both a minister and a former social worker. She stated that a thorough review had been conducted by the Provincial Director of Child Welfare regarding the Ministry of Children and Family Development and their involvement with foster children. The review revealed that not all of MCFD's policies had been followed at the Hope BC office. This is near Lake Arrock. The MCFD also stated that individuals who neglected to conduct welfare checks on the children from the ministry's Hope office are no longer part of the organization. So they fired low-level social workers when it's clearly a systemic issue. So due to privacy considerations, the MCFD has not disclosed whether these individuals are terminated or whether they left voluntarily, nor have they disclosed the number of staff members that were affected by this particular case. When asked for specifics on which policies and procedures were not followed and why, Mitzi Dean reiterated her condolences and the tragic nature of this situation, but did not provide any further details. Now, the very last line of the RCY investigation into the Allen Schoenborn case is as follows. The legacy of Caitlin, Max, and Corden must not be their senseless and violent deaths, but that other BC children are better protected in the future. Now, based on everything we've just told you and everything that's happened in this episode, whether or not these children's legacies has been honored is up to you to decide. In 2012, Christy Clark, the then Premier of British Columbia, apologized for the failure of the province's system of domestic violence services that did not protect Darcy and her children, given the past issues surrounding Allan's mental health. On March 31st, 2015, the home where the murders took place was demolished. Community members in Merritt had been asking for the structure to be removed for years. The owner of the property agreed, but he wanted the cost of the demolition to be shared with the municipality. Finally, an agreement was struck. The teardown scene elicited thumbs up from several passing motorists. Neighbors and passerby said the removal of the trailer or the mobile home comes as a relief and the beginning of some closure. Another tragedy in this story occurred on the evening of March 30th, 2019. Darcy Clark, the mother of Caitlin, Corden, and Max, died. After the death of her children, Clark moved to the Tri-Cities area in the Lower Mainland. She became an advocate of victims' rights, but never got over the heartbreak of losing her family. Unlike more outspoken families of other murder victims, Darcy kept a low profile. But her quiet pursuit of justice for her three children led her to share her story with some of Canada's top political leaders to push for change. Darcy died in Kamloops, British Columbia, and she was just 48 years old. Her family was tormented by an evil man, then an uncaring justice and review board system. My hope is that Darcy's legacy will be that we as a society care more for women, children, and victims of crime than we do for a murderer, and that we provide better support for those who suffer from mental illness. I hope Darcy's broken heart can now rest in peace.
That's all we have for this TNTC Plus exclusive episode. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you soon with a new episode. Until then, take care of yourselves and each other.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.